The reading is taken from Exodus 32 on page 90. Exodus 32, page 90. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered round Aaron and said, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him." Aaron answered them, "Take off the gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing, and bring them to me." So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord." So the next day the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. Afterwards they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go down, because your people, whom you brought up out of Egypt, have become corrupt. They have been quick to turn away from what I commanded them, and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They have bowed down to it and sacrificed to it, and have said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt.' I have seen these people," the Lord said to Moses, "and they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone, so that my anger may burn against them, and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation." But Moses sought the favor of the Lord his God. "O Lord," he said, "why should your anger burn against your people, whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, 'It was with evil intent that he brought them out, to kill them in the mountains and to wipe them off the face of the earth'? Turn from your fierce anger, relent, and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, to whom you swore by your own self, 'I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give your descendants all this land I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever.'" Then the Lord relented and did not bring on his people the disaster he had threatened.
Thank you, Lucy. Now, I don't suppose it's escaped your attention that we're just coming up to the start of wedding season here at St. Helens. The invitations have been sent out, the preparations, I guess, have been made, the bookings have been booked and so on, and there are going to be six or seven major St. Helens weddings over the next 5 weeks alone. Maybe that explains Phil's extraordinary generosity this evening. I suspect he's probably just run out of change. This time in just 7 days, the first of the summer couples will be relaxing in their secret honeymoon hideaway in Bognor, or where was it, Julian? Somewhere like that. And we'll be underway. Now, I'm sure some of us have been to weddings where the bride seems to be strangely reluctant to accept the offer of the relationship. She whispers or mutters something rather timidly under her breath, I will. I remember one wedding one of our family went to where the bride was simply unable to utter the words, "I will." For a full 20 minutes she was sobbing and weeping uncontrollably. Such was the momentous occasion. Water, I find, is a good solution in that kind of situation. At the end of last week's sermon in this series in the book of Exodus, we saw God's people gathered at the base of this mountain, almost leaping into the arms of their God to accept his gracious offer of a continued relationship. Do you remember there was none of this coy reluctance about the Israelites? Just have a look at chapter 19, verse 8. They've been given this offer by God to continue in relationship with him. People all responded together, 19 verse 8, "We will do everything the Lord has said." They all responded together. 24 verse 3. When Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded with one voice. "Everything the Lord has said, we will do. It was an unreserved, uninhibited, I will. And then, if you're still in Exodus 24, you'll see in verses 15 to 18, Moses leaves God's new bride, if you like, his gathered people at the foot of the mountain, and he sets off up the mountain to receive instructions from the Lord as to how this people would have their God dwelling amongst them as a privileged people with a unique purpose. And so it's no mistake that that opening section of the second half of the book, chapter 19 through 24, is called one of the great mountain peaks of the Bible. But while Moses is away, the most dreadful scene imaginable develops, and the scene is described in verses 1 to 6 of our reading and gives us our first heading for this evening, the damning evidence. See, God's people quickly lose patience with the one true God who has rescued them, and they turn to put their trust elsewhere, even though only a few days earlier at the foot of the mountain, God had spoken to them openly, clearly, and they had had a full verbal, visual revelation of God. Just have a look at verse 1. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered round Aaron and said, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him." Now flick back to chapter 20, and we'll hold ourselves in chapter 20, verses 1 to 3, on and off in the next few moments. Remember how God had revealed himself verbally? "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of slavery, out of the land of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me." And here they are, just a few days later, leaping into the arms of somebody else. Verse 4, God's people don't any turn. They quickly forget the rescuing acts of the one true God and attribute their rescue to something they've made themselves. Look at verse 4 in chapter 32, keeping a hand, if you can, in verse chapter 20. "Aaron took what they handed him and made it into an idol, cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt.'" But remember chapter 20, verse 1? God said, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery." See, God is the only one who rescued them. That was the whole point of the whole of the first half of the book of Exodus. That was the point of the plagues, the judgment on Egypt, the miraculous parting of the sea, the feeding in the desert, to show that Yahweh, the I Am, eternal God, is the only true God. Yet in 32 verse 4, in this desperate descent, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." Then look at verse 6. "So the next day the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings, and afterwards they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry." And apparently the word for revelry there has sexual connotations. Just a few days earlier, God had been expounding his character to them as the one true faithful God and calling them on them as his people with a unique purpose, to witness to him amongst the nations that he is faithful. And he called on them, therefore, to be faithful in their relationships with one another. Just a few days later, they've turned from him. And now they're rampant in their adultery. Psalm 106, page 609, carries the Old Testament commentary on what's going on here. And it's very revealing. So, page 609. Psalm 106, verse 19. "At Horeb, they made a calf, and they worshipped an idol cast from metal. They exchanged their glory for an image of a bull which eats grass. They forgot the God who saved them, who'd done great things in Egypt, miracles in the land of Ham, and awesome deeds by the Red Sea." See those two key words, exchange, forget. They exchanged their glory. They forgot God. I guess all of us are familiar with the idea of swapping things, aren't we? It's a sort of everyday kind of thing. It's going all on all the time, and substitutions are being made all over France at the moment. But here at the foot of this mountain, the Israelites make a substitution, a swap, an exchange. They exchange the holy God of absolute divine authority and absolute moral purity. They exchange the God of grace and good, gracious rule for an idol of their own making. Just remember last week, you know, we were given the verbal and the visual revelation, demonstration of God's holiness. Remember, these people were told that they're a unique people with a unique past and a unique privilege of having this holy God dwelling amongst them and a unique purpose to witness to the nations. And what do? Well, they turn. Within days, they turn their back and exchange the one true living God. And they begin to attribute to something else of their own making all the qualities that rightly belong to God. It's a horrific picture, isn't it? You know, it's as if after the wedding ceremony has taken place and the contract has been sealed and the register signed, towards the end of the reception, the bride heads off towards the room in which she's going to change to get into her going away things. And while she's still there, as the words "I will" are still ringing on her lips, well, an ex-boyfriend steps in and they sleep together. Shamelessly. And the scene here at the mountain while Moses is away is so desperate and the evidence so damning that it's tempting to try and excuse the people by watering down the rebellion. After all, verse 1, Moses was, well, he was a long time in coming back. Must have been easy, mustn't it, to wonder where he was. Following the mountain peak of chapter 19, God now seemed to be so remote. And so gradually, gently, they drifted from obeying his words. Well, we can't really blame them. I mean, it's fully understandable, isn't it? In Moses' absence, they've just been through the most dreadful period of national upheaval. This is, well, it's just a little slip-up that stems from the anticlimax after the events of the mountain peak. That is the style of explanation, isn't it, of Aaron in verses 21 to 24. Just slip over the page, but just look on to verses 21 and 24. Moses, when he got down the mountain, said to Aaron, "What did these people do to you that you led them into such a great sin?" "Don't be angry, my lord," Aaron answered. "You know how prone these people are to evil. They said to me, 'Make us gods who will go before us.' As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. So I told them, 'Whoever has any gold jewelry, take it off.' Then they gave me the gold, I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf." Staggering, isn't it? "Don't go over the top, old man. You know, don't be angry with me. I know we've done a few things wrong, but well, you shouldn't take it that seriously." But that kind of excusing of the Israelites simply doesn't wash either with the immediate text or with the wider context. Look at verse 8. What is God's verdict? "They've been quick to turn away from what I commanded them and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf." Look at verse 4. It wasn't a case of just kind of an extraordinary coincidence as Aaron threw in the gold and out popped this idol. No, he took what they'd handed him. He made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. It's premeditated, isn't it? Look at verse 5. "Aaron then went on to build an altar in front of the calf and announce, 'Tomorrow there'll be a festival to the Lord.'" You see, it's a clear, deliberate act. Verse 6. A deliberate sacrifice, exchange. So they attribute something to something of their own making, all the qualities that rightly belong to God alone. They give to something of their own making all the service, all the devotion, all the honor, all the time, all the energy that rightly belongs to God alone. They exchange the glory of the immortal God who's met with them on the mountain for images made to look like animals. And to make light of this fall is not only to avoid the immediate context, but also the wider context. You see, this group, let's not forget, this group are amongst the most privileged group in the whole of the Old Testament. They've just had as much as a face-to-face encounter with the holy, gracious God. They've witnessed his powerful rescuing acts as he brought them out of Egypt. They've been privileged the most full-scale revelation of God in the whole of the Old Testament. You will have read ministers speaking of the hooligans in Marseille, saying it's no good muttering things about poor schooling or disadvantaged home lives or low incomes. There is no excuse. And God won't allow his people to come up with this weak, feeble excuse. We just drifted into it, you know. He knows the score. He's seen what went on. He's aware of the circumstances, the motives, the intent, and the excuses won't wash. But again, the evidence is so damning that some commentators have sought to excuse the Israelites by focusing on verse 5. Just have a look down at verse 5. So you could find an excuse there if you were really trying hard. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord, to Yahweh, to the great God of the Israelites." Well, at least they kept the Lord in the picture as they turned away to worship other gods. It doesn't seem to have been a full-scale abandonment of Yahweh, does it? This was merely adding a bit on, hedging your bets a bit. It doesn't really look as bad as you might say. It's just a temporary hiccup. But once again, that just doesn't wash, because when we go back to look at the Ten Commandments, which we were looking at last week, we find that God defined himself over and against all other gods. He is unique in his absolute divine authority. That's the whole point about holiness. Do you remember we looked at the word holiness? It means separate, other, apart. Just the word on its own makes the point. Just have a look at Exodus chapter 20 and verse 5. "You shall not bow down to them," that's idols, "or worship them." Why? "Because I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation." And we know that the idol the Israelites chose to carve was the same kind of idol that the neighboring nations regularly bound to, the bull bearing the symbol of strength and fertility. So do you see what they're doing? They are reducing God and placing him on a par with their own chosen carved image. If anything, trying to mix in other gods as a potpourri of gods or a Kellogg's variety pack, given the way God has defined himself as the only true God, if anything, trying to mix him in and put him on a par, well, that's even worse than full-scale, outright rejection. There is no excuse. They have willfully, deliberately turned away from God. They've done a swap, an exchange. They've turn from the true and living God to worship a few gold earrings and attributed to something of their own making, all that rightfully belongs to God. Again, we sometimes find people trying to water down this passage by taking this passage and applying it to the non-Christian world. Now, you'll find this over and again, the Ten Commandments and this passage taken and used to wag the finger at the pagan world, the non-Christian world. But that completely misses the point of this second half of the book of Exodus. You see, if you've been with us over the last 3 years, it's obvious, isn't it, that these are God's people. He rescued them. They belong to him. They've already signed the deal, the relationship. They've entered into relationship with him. And it is the people of God here who are exchanging the truth of God for a lie. At the foot of the mountain. It's his own people. We can't take this passage and use it and avoid its implications by turning to the outside world and wagging the finger in sort of moral criticism at them. No, this is towards God's people, this passage. So do you see the damning evidence? Within days of signing the register, God's people are learning a key lesson. There's nothing good within them that makes them worthy of a relationship with him. Nothing in their devotion. No, it's divided. Nothing in their service. It's spoiled. Nothing in their behavior. It's bad. And any one of us who's been a Christian for any length of time surely must echo that truth as we come to the Ten Commandments So we are brought to the foot of the mountain and the damning evidence. Are you a city worker or a medic or a young professional? How often we attribute to something of our own making all the qualities that rightly belong to God alone. Our career so easily becomes paramount. We hold the job, the bonus, the income, the salary as the source of real security and confidence. Are you a student? How easily we give to something of human origin all the service and devotion that rightfully belongs to God as we pursue those precious letters, considering them to be the source of all security. Are you a paid Christian worker? Well, how often we look to our own performance or our own programs or our own personalities or even the pleasing of men and their opinions and reckon these things to be the source of our security and confidence. Maybe none of those things. Maybe it's a relationship that you long for to give you security, all the things that rightly belong to God. Maybe it's a possession, an achievement, an aim. There is no excusing it. Someone might come and pat us on the shoulder. There, Paul or Pam or Patsy. Everybody's doing it, you know. It's not surprising, really. We live in an idolatrous world. No wonder you don't hold completely to God. God knows. You just drifted into it. It's not really your fault. Someone else comes up, puts their arm around our shoulder, and never mind Simon or Steve or Sarah. At least you're still holding on to Jesus just with a tiny little corner there. Even if you do have quite a few other passengers in the boat as well. Someone else might come along and say, well, just have a look at the pagan world. You know, you're not as bad as them. But what we learn from verses 1 to 6 is that there is no excuse. It is deliberate, our idolatry. Verse 3. So all the people took off their earrings. They brought them to Aaron. He took what they handed him, made it into an idol, cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of Egypt, and these are God's people. And we can't claim that we haven't had the full revelation of God here in St. Helens. We've got it actually on our knees. We must be among the most privileged group of the most privileged generation of any Christians of all time. We're well taught, I hope. We're easily able to meet each other. We have plenty of friends to encourage us. We have every available source of encouragement. We know that God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, is holy, that he demands holiness, and yet time and time again, my personal experience is that I attribute to other things of my own making what rightly belongs to God alone. And so chapter 32 of Exodus is designed to show God's people a key lesson. The damning evidence that just as we were unfit to have him dwell amongst us when he rescued us, so following the rescue, after he's chosen us, if you like, so then we are unfit to have him dwell amongst us. And of course that leaves us asking the question, so what? I mean, what is the consequence for God's people? If that's the damning evidence, what of God's plan for his people who he rescued out of Egypt? And that takes us on to the second point. The dreadful consequence. And it's there in verses 7 to 10. And here's the point. Like everybody else in this world, God's people everywhere deserve God's full and absolute judgment. And it's there in the text. You can't miss it, verse 7. See the first thing God does? Go down because, he says to Moses, not my people. Go down because your people, who you brought out, have become corrupt. Do you see? No longer the language of treasured possession, ownership, belonging. They are now described as Moses' people. Have a look at verse 10. Now leave me alone, that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Instead of being the subject of his loving care, they're now the object of his wrath. Turn over to verse 19. Where we see verse 19, when Moses approached the camp, he saw the calf, the dancing, his anger burned. He threw down the tablets out of his hands, breaking them in pieces, symbolizing the smashing of the relationship. Verse 27, as we see the plagues that had broken out against the Egyptians, and verse 35, plagues that had broken out against the Egyptians in judgment on them back in the earlier chapters of Exodus are now breaking out on his own people in judgment against them. And most damning of all, 33 verse 3. Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you. We have a friend, she was married once, he was a lovely guy, they had a great wedding, they seemed the perfect couple, they had a glorious honeymoon, they moved into a delightful house, they were all set to be Mr. and Mrs. Wright. 4 weeks after their wedding day, he came home one evening and announced that he was having an affair with a girl at work. No remorse, no regret, no further explanation, he packed his bags and was gone. All over. And I remember her father, with tears in his eyes, telling the story and admitting helplessly, I just don't know where it all went wrong. His little girl, her dreams in tatters, the relationship shattered, all her hopes smashed. And it's as if God's people here, standing at the foot of the mountain, have still got the wedding dress on. But the divorce papers are in their hands, and their plans of a life together are in tatters. Last week it all seemed so great, didn't it? The holy God of Israel, the good God of Israel, full of grace, with his chosen people on this mountainside honeymoon. Unique past, unique privilege, unique purpose. But we hadn't taken into account verses 7 to 9. The Lord said to Moses, go down, because your people, whom you brought out of Egypt, have become corrupt. They've been quick to turn away from what I commanded them, and have made for themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They've bowed down to it, sacrificed to it, and said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. I have seen these people, the Lord said to Moses. They are a stiff-necked people. And verse 10, he determines to make a fresh start, leaving them out of the picture. And of course, it's absolutely right, isn't it, that God responds this way towards his people, isn't it? I mean, I hope we're not going to fall into the trap this evening of thinking that, we secretly ought to condemn God for behaving in this way towards his people. One of the things that the Ten Commandments teach us about God that we rejoice in is that he is righteous and consistent and pure and holy. So here is a group of people who have wantonly and willfully perpetrated one of the most severe acts of rebellion in the whole of history. Days earlier, God proclaimed his name amongst them. They're amongst the most privileged people in the whole of the Old Testament. If God doesn't act in righteous judgment against these people at the foot of the mountain, well, he's not going to act in righteous judgment against any of his enemies. That's the whole point of Paul's argument in Romans 3. If he simply swept these people's sins under the carpet and pretended they didn't happen, well, then what right would he have to judge anybody in the world? So here is the dreadful consequence that flows from the damning evidence. Just because this racial group of Israelites happened to be there at the mountain and signed the covenant, they're not excluded from the demands. And they're not excluded from the righteous, just judgment of God. Rebellion must be punished. Justice must be done. And so they're taught this key lesson that we need to learn. The damning evidence. The dreadful consequence that God's people, like all people everywhere in the whole world, deserve God's full and absolute judgment. His justice demands it. But of course, this lesson drives us forward into the passage to say again, so what? What of this plan that we've been learning about for God to take a people to belong to him forever? Does this stand shattered? Is there any hope for it? And that takes us into verses 11 to 14. The damning evidence, the dreadful consequence, the divine acceptance. And here's the point. God's acceptance of his people always did and always will rely entirely on his mercy and grace promised to us in his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, do you remember a couple of weeks ago that we saw that God's rescue of his people way back in the first half of Exodus was entirely dependent on a promise he'd made hundreds of years before to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he was being consistent in keeping his promise. Well, now we learn that not only does the rescue depend entirely on his mercy and grace, but the ongoing relationship depends entirely on the mercy and grace of God. And you can see it if we look closely at the text in verse 10, 11, 12, and 13. So heads down. Verse 10, "Now leave me alone, so that my anger may burn against them, and then I will make you, Moses, into a great nation." So there's the consequence. He wants to make a fresh start. Verses 11 to 13, Moses then appeals to God on what? On the basis of his long-term promise made to Abraham. Look at verse 11. "Moses sought the favor of the Lord. Why should your anger burn against your people who you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand?" That's appealing to God who rescued his people on the basis of his promise to Abraham. "Why should the Egyptians say it was with evil intent that he brought us out to kill them in the mountains and to wipe them off the face of the earth?" That is appealing to God on the basis of his purpose for his people, that all nations should be blessed through them. That purpose, you can see in verse 13, is all founded on his promise made hundreds of years before to Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, to whom you swore by your own self, "I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. I will give your descendants all this land I promised, and it will be in their inheritance forever." I remember one of the recent election campaigns, one of the political parties put out a whole center spread in one of the main broadsheets. I don't think it was the Daily Mail. On it were passport-sized photos of dozens of their political rivals who will remain nameless. But each photo had under it a caption that contained a promise or a claim made by that politician at some stage in the previous 5 years, which had now been upended by the new manifesto. It was devastatingly unfair, I thought. But there we are. We love consistency. We rightly expect faithful consistency in the political realm, which I guess is why politicians are often so unwilling to answer the questions of a Jeremy Paxman in case they get pinned down a few years later. But Moses' appeal to God here is on the basis of his consistency, his promise that God would act in faithful consistency with his name and his character, not moving on to a new plan, a plan B, and taking Moses and making a fresh start, but sticking with plan A. So do you see, the appeal there is not to suggest that God is changing his mind, but to show us that God is continuing with his consistent plan to rescue a people and call them to themselves. And as we move on into the rest of Exodus and Leviticus, so we're going to see God continuing to demonstrate how he can dwell amongst his people and have a relationship with them, all on the basis of providing a way to deal with this rebellion. It's all going to be his work, on the basis of having promised hundreds of years ago to rescue them and make them into his people. And so we learn that the rescue, as we learned in chapters 1 to 18, is based entirely on God's grace and mercy. And then the ongoing relationship is based entirely on God's grace and mercy. Well, now let's draw a few threads together as we close. The damning evidence. What does it mean? What is there to take home for us? Well, we should have learned a lesson, a key lesson for ourselves this evening. We are as wretchedly rebellious now as we were the day God called us to belong to him. We may have polished the bonnet a bit. We may have put the net curtains up and the window boxes in place that give the impression of all being well. But when we look on the inside and are exposed by the Ten Commandments, we find that Christian people are idolatrous. There's nothing in us that makes us deserving of a relationship with God. Our devotion is always divided. Isn't that so for you? Our service is always spoiled. Our behavior is always bad, tainted by our rebellion. That's certainly Paul's assessment, as he said, "A wretched man that I am, who will rescue me?" And we need to be clear on this here at St. Helens. You know, some Christians get the impression that Christian life is a steady climb from one peak of purity to the next. But my experience, and I'm sure yours, is that it's much more like snakes and ladders. And if we don't come to terms with the reality of Christian experience expressed here, then we'll just go on playing let's pretend for the rest of our lives. We'll play let's pretend with each other, pretend all is swimmingly wonderful, forgetting that each of us is as wretchedly rebellious as we were when the day we began. And we'll find that we become crippled in our Christian service as we try to deny the fact that we are as wretchedly rebellious as the day we began. So the damning evidence, the dreadful consequence. If we don't realize that we deserve as much as anybody the full anger and judgment of God, then we will simply become like the Pharisees of the New Testament. Remember them? They thought they'd got it cracked. They had the surface polished, but when you looked under the bonnet, they were as bad as the next person. But because they thought they had it all polished, they looked down their nose at everybody around them. There was no compassion, no concern, no credibility at the end of the day in their lives. So if we don't come to terms with the fact that we deserve God's judgment, just like the next person, we will become arrogant hypocrites. And we will lose our compassion for the outside world. The damning evidence, the dreadful consequence, the divine acceptance. Well, it should result in our overflowing in gratitude and thanksgiving. That all the privileges that God has for his people, the privilege of having him dwelling amongst us, the privilege of having an international purpose to be a blessing to the nations, is not because of anything we've done. It is only because from way back, thousands of years ago, he promised to rescue us on the basis of his mercy, and his promise has come to fulfillment in the sacrifice of Jesus. Well, now let's take a moment to think about those words. We're going to sing Only by Grace, which really sums up everything we've been looking at. But before we sing it, let's just take a moment to look through the passage to allow what we've been learning to sink in.